turned out nice again, hasn't it?
And then...
I know drug reel from real reel.
And then...
You're only supposed to blow the bloody doors off.
And then...
I want to get online. I need a computer.
And then...
When Marrakesh is overrun by mutant lizard people, don't come crying to me.
And then...
Warriors, come out to play.
And then...
Well, who'd want to marry me now? I've waited around so long, I'm plumb wasted away.
That may be, honey. But what you got left over is more than what most folks starts out with.
And then...
Hello and welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast number 28. Yes, we've survived this long and we'll continue to do so as long as you guys and ladies keep downloading the silly thing. My name's Terry Frost, and in this podcast I'm talking about dealing with the devil. By that I don't mean American taxation. I know you guys are paying your taxes soon, so it's nothing to do with that at all. It's Faust. Everyone knows Faust. Classic. Yeah, deal with the devil, get what you like in return, devil shafts you, you go to hell. That kind of thing. So we're doing a bit of that this time around. How are you guys? We're doing fine here. The weather's starting to turn towards winter in the southern hemisphere, which means we actually get things like clouds and rain instead of 48 degree heat. So not a bad thing there. I'll tell you what the movies are, then I'll tell you what I've been doing lately. The movies we're going to look at this time, three of them. Damn Yankees from 1957, I think. I will check that. Bedazzled, the original version, not the really shit one with Liz Hurley in it. And also Phantom of the Paradise, Brian De Palma's rock musical horror comedy pastiche thing from 1974. So they're the three movies we're going to be looking at, and I'll talk about them a lot more just a little bit later. Okay, how are you guys doing? Yeah, I've got some new listeners to Paleo Cinema, which is quite pleasing. I was looking at the geographical statistics, and we're getting listeners in places like India, Turkey, Spain, Jamaica, Argentina, or Argentina, whichever you prefer. And great, thanks a lot for that, people. I hope you continue to enjoy the podcast. It's always interesting to go into the... statistics and see where people are listening, and apart from the usual suspects in Europe and North America, it's good to see a little bit of diversity happening there. Podcasting is a global phenomenon, and it always pleases me a lot when I hear people from all around the world listening in, and thank you very much for that. Really appreciate it, and I hope you continue to enjoy the podcast. So what have I been watching lately? A few things. One of the best things that I've seen lately that I really want to recommend to people is a movie called Big Night. It's from 1996. It's way outside the Paleo Cinema thing, but this one's so good, I've got to tell you about it. Great movie. It's the story basically, it stars Stanley Tucci and Tony Shalhoub, Isabella Rossellini and Ian Holm, amongst others. It's a food movie, so there's a lot of good food pornography in this one. So Stanley Tucci and Tony Shalhoub star as a pair of Italian immigrant brothers in New Jersey in the 1950s who are running an unsuccessful restaurant. The Tony Shalhoub character is a fantastic cook. He's like genius level Italian chef. And in America in the 1950s, they really wanted meatballs with their spaghetti, and they didn't understand Italian cooking beyond the kind of bastardized Italian cooking, kind of like the bastardized Chinese cooking you get in a lot of places these days. The restaurant's not doing well, and a more successful restaurateur, played by Ian Holm, tells them he's going to help them, and he's going to get Louis Prima, the singer, to come to their restaurant. They'll generate some buzz, some publicity, get some people in to taste how wonderful this food is, and help their restaurant out. In the meantime, the Stanley Tucci character's having an affair with... Isabella Rossellini, playing Ian Holm's wife, so there's a subtext there. but it's one of those great small films where the characters are fantastic, the actors are all terrific, and it builds its time and place and generates such a warmth towards the characters that it's just one of those movies that you realize that this is what cinema's about. It's not about blockbusters, CGI, and whether they can make Brad Pitt look like a shrunken old man. Definitely see it. It's called Big Night. It's also got good character actors like Allison Janney and Campbell Scott in it. Campbell Scott was one of the co-producers of the film. Just a great film. It ends with quite a long, quiet sequence, no dialogue at all, which I really enjoyed. So going to have to get that on DVD. I saw it on cable, but it's definitely on my list of one of the best films I saw this year. Last night I went over to some friend's place too. The other thing I saw was got my first dose of Blu-ray because my friend Jamie said, oh, you got to watch Blu-ray. You know, Blu-ray's fantastic. You can see every pimple on everyone's ass kind of thing. So we went and saw The Mist over at their place. We had some nice spaghetti marinara first, linking into the Italian food theme of this podcast, obviously. Then watched The Mist, which I'd seen previously and I recommend as a fantastic horror film. On Blu-ray, and yeah, it does look terrific. The sound was fantastic. The sharpness of the image was definitely there. It was a good experience, and at some stage, when the pennies trickle in, Sal and I will get a Blu-ray player and start accruing, I'm sure, a lot of Blu-ray discs. But right now, it's not on the budget. The thing that is on the budget, my birthday's coming up in April. So Sally, in her infinite wisdom, is springing out to buy me a Blue Snowball microphone. Now, if you type Blue Snowball microphone into Google, you'll see what I mean. It's a round, top-end microphone. The setup I've got here is quite good, and I'm not trying to put that down. It was another present from Sally as well. But Blue Snowballs, basically, the thing that it has over the rig I've got at the moment is it's an omnidirectional microphone, so I will be able to start getting people in to talk about movies with me, which is something that I have wanted to do in Paleo Cinema for a while, but the logistics of just having one rather phallic microphone on an arm sitting here for the podcast kind of precludes that. I wanted to have a setup where I can put the thing on a table with a laptop, just have people chat in a normal voice and pick it up in a way that I can transcribe for the podcast. So I will be doing that. The microphone is in the mail, and so I'm having a little bit of techno rapture about getting that. But on with the show. I did get mail. We got mail. Fantastic. Love it. Always love it. I'll just read a little bit of that. There was somebody who said they were going to send me an MP3 to play on the podcast. You know who you are. Still waiting for it. And I would love to get any kind of comments there. I don't care what people sound like. I don't care if the sound quality on a condenser mic isn't up to a broadcast quality. That's not what it's about. It's about people having their voice heard and talking about love of movies. Now, there are people out there that have got, they're differently knowledgeable about movies than I am, and I really want to kind of give them a bit of a voice in the podcast as well. I'll read the letters in the meantime. I'm not going to embarrass that person any further. On with the letters.
After reviewing all personnel files, I have selected you to serve as long as you cooperate as my link to your species.
Okay, the first letter is from Dave Kosnick, who's a friend of Monty's. And you remember that Monty has written emails to Paleo Cinema before, and he's a frequent poster on the chat window at the website, paleo-cinema.blogspot.com. There is a chat window there, so you can just leave a little comment there and I will respond to it every day or two. So there's another way of you interacting with other people on the podcast. Anyway, Dave says, Monty, a friend of mine, turned me onto your podcast, and I must say they're brilliant. Oh, shucks. I was listening to your Vincent Price podcast, and I was a little shocked that you didn't mention the abominable Dr. Fibes, or Dr. Fibes Rises Again. Granted, I haven't seen all the films, but those two rank right up there for me. Monty was over this evening, and of course we talked film. I mentioned to him two films, Wise Blood and Angst. Wise Blood is on my top five movies. Have you seen either? keep up the great work, Dave. Okay, Dave, yeah. I was going to mention the Dr. Fibes films in the Vincent Price podcast. It was a year or two ago now that I did that podcast, but I remember there was so much good Vincent Price stuff that I had to do some trimming somewhere, and unfortunately those ones did fall through the cracks a little bit. Yeah, I do like them. I think that while they're not the absolute best Vincent Price movies, they do have a weird kind of gothic style to them and a kind of wonderful outrageousness that definitely puts them on the list of fun things to watch with Vincent Price in them. So, yep, it was an omission, but sometimes you've got to trim with these things, and unfortunately those ones fell through. No, I haven't seen Wise Blood or Angst. I have put them on my list, and I'm looking around for copies of them, so definitely willing to take recommendations and look at them. It's just a matter of accessing the films themselves. I do have a written list in one of my podcast notebooks for things like that, and those movies have been added to it. So thanks for the feedback and also for the recommendations, Dave, and please keep listening. I hope you're enjoying the podcast. I got another email from our old pal Serps, who has been down with a bit of a flu bug lately, so I hope you're feeling better, and I'll just read parts of the letter. Hello, Terry. I've been down with a bubonic something or other, and so I never got the chance to comment on your last podcast. I will say that it was such a success that I ordered and watched the DVD of Roadhouse after hearing you talk about it on your podcast. Everyone remembers Roadhouse. It was the Cornel Wilde, Richard Widmark, Ida Lupino film I talked about two podcasts ago. It goes on to say, somehow I'd never heard of Roadhouse before Paleo Cinema. Imagine my surprise. Ida Lupino, Richard Widmark, in a film noir so hothouse and delirious it verges on science fiction. What a tour de force. It does seem to me that Cornel Wilde was always rather overlooked. He always provided a good, solid performance, but his movies seem to find him competing against the major pyrotechnic acting partner. For instance, in Leave It to Heaven, he has a thankless job of standing next to Gene Tierney, the blockbuster killer shrew, while in Roadhouse, poor Cornel had to survive against two twin titans of Ida Lupino and Richard Widmark, both giving explosive performances. I got step out of it for a moment. Yeah, absolutely. Cornel Wilde was a good, solid performer, very intelligent man. He did some movies of his own later in his career. I mentioned, of course, Naked Prey in a podcast. Beach Red's another one he did, and No Blade of Grass. So he did these very personal action films later in his career, which have some weird stuff in them in some ways. There's a lot of voiceover of what the character's thinking and things like that, and some unusually used flashback sequences in some of those films. Cornel Wilde's movies are worth seeing if you get a chance, particularly those latter ones that he directed and in some cases wrote for himself. But yeah, I always liked him as an actor. I liked him in this in 1001 Nights with Phil Silvers. It's a movie from the 1940s. If you get a chance to see it on TV, I don't believe it's out on DVD, but if you get a chance to see it, it's a really fun little Arabian Nights comedy, which I remember fondly from my childhood. But I'll go on with Serp's letter. Well, did love to see Secret of the Incas as well, but it doesn't appear to be available on DVD around these parts. I especially want to track the film down after you mentioned it's a kind of companion piece to Charlton Heston's The Naked Jungle, which I'm also a big fan of. And, of course, the extraterrestrial Yuma Sumac's presence is a big plus as well. It was also good to hear you talk about the stylish Thomas Crown affair with two shits, Steve McQueen and Faye Dunaway, who combined pack more charisma and personality than the entire population of modern Hollywood combined. Yeah, absolutely. They were just fantastic together. They kind of really worked well together. Two intelligent and kind of non-mainstream actors working together is always an interesting combination. Now on to your newest Creepy English Children podcast. That was terrific. I've always been a huge fan of George Sanders as well as Village of the Damned. Your excellent tribute to George Sanders in the newest podcast was really great. A couple of years ago, Warner Brothers released both Village and Children of the Damned on a single DVD, and I highly recommend picking that up. It's quite cheap, as I recall, and the film prints both look great. I also heartily agree that Children, while interesting, is nowhere near the same caliber as Village of the Damned. I'd also agree with you that the acting in Children is quite good, but somehow the film doesn't match its predecessor. Ian Hendry, I always thought, was a very interesting actor that never seemed to find his place in movies. I don't think the studios knew quite what to do with him, and he never found his true iconic film role. Also, I found Children to have a strangely Eurospy or German crimmy feel about it. I quite agree that the sequel isn't scary at all, while Village is quite unsettling and suspenseful. Sadly, after hearing your description of The Damned, I must admit to not having seen that film. However, I have the film trailer on the Hammer Film Trailer DVD, which I can watch until I track down The Damned. I won't go into any more of Seth's letter, it is quite long, but I definitely enjoyed it, and thanks for the feedback in the rest of the letter as well. The three movies are work well together, and if you can get a copy of The Damned, definitely see it. It is quite disturbing and memorable, as I said last time. I will pick up the double set of Children and Village of the Damned at some stage. But, this is what it's all about. It's about sharing love of film. And I won't do any more letters at the moment because it's getting on, and I've got three movies to talk to, and I've got a few things to say about them. So I'll just put a little bit of a break in here and get on with the first of the film, Damn Yankees.
Whatever Lola wants, Lola gets. A little man, little Lola wants you. Make up your mind to have no regrets. Recline yourself, resign yourself, you're through. I always gave. Is what I came for.
Okay, I know that wasn't the version of the song from the movie. That was Chiwetel Ejiofor in a movie called Kinky Boots singing a song from Damn Yankees. He was playing a drag queen called Lola in that film, so that explains why a guy was singing it rather than a woman. Anyway, Damn Yankees. Going to talk about that now. I'm not going to talk a lot about it because there are only a few aspects to it that I really, really like. I'm going to skip all the baseball stuff, not into sports films. Though Chiwetel Ejiofor was in a sports film that I did like, Red Belt, the David Mamet movie, which was about sports martial arts. And it takes someone like David Mamet to make a movie about sports that I'll watch. And so there's your link between the two films and between Chiwetel Ejiofor and also Damn Yankees. So Damn Yankees started on the stage, like a lot of musicals from the 1950s. 1955, big hit on Broadway, did fantastically well. Ray Walston was in it playing Mr. Applegate, who's the devil. Gwen Verdon played Lola. And they dragged a lot of the cast from the Broadway production over to the production for the screen, which was directed by Stanley Donen and George Abbott. Why am I talking about this? Because it's a Faust legend. A middle-aged baseball fan decides that he's going to sell his soul to the devil so that his team can win and beat the Yankees. So the devil, Mr. Applegate, played by Ray Walston, decides that what he's going to do is turn this middle-aged guy into a young killer baseball player, and once the team wins, he gets the soul, takes him off to hell, does all the usual devil things. Now, this is by no means the first time the Faust legend has been done. It dates back for at least 400 or 500 years. There were little chapbooks about it. People like Christopher Marlowe, Goethe, Thomas Mann, Hector Berlioz, Franz Liszt, Gustav Mahler, and F.W. Murnau all had a go at doing Faust. And, of course, there are lots of modern interpretations of people selling their soul to the devil and getting the raw end of the deal. Each one of the thing is that it's a very malleable legend. There are the Faust legends were about secular knowledge being given to a person by the devil rather than divine knowledge. So there was a conflict between church and state there. And in the early Faust books, Faust was criticized for being refusing to call himself a doctor of theology, but preferring to be styled a doctor of medicine. It was about the received knowledge from God versus the knowledge that people have based on scientific evidence. So it kind of came in at the time when the Enlightenment was coming through, and there was a lot of tension between the old school philosophies and the newer reality-based philosophies. Lots, and but the thing is that Goethe's Faust is a lot different from that. He reworked the story 2 centuries after it started, and Faust became a dissatisfied intellectual who just basically wanted to know more things. He was hungry for information. He's the sort of guy that the internet was made for. So, but Damn Yankees, I think, suffers compared to the other two movies that I'm going to talk about, mostly because what this guy wants is for some bunch of jocks to do better than some other bunch of jocks. The reason why the person is selling their soul to the devil seems, to me at least, to be an incredibly trivial one. It's just about being able to go, stuff you Yankees. But I'm going to talk about the bits that I do like. I'll leave aside all the baseball stuff, some of the songs that I didn't particularly like, and kind of go to the heart of why I like this film. 2 reasons, 2 people. Gwen Verdon, excellent actress, dancer and singer, and Bob Fosse, who did the choreography and who does a dance number with Gwen Verdon in the film. Basically, Gwen Verdon was hot. Redhead, great dancer, probably the best interpreter of the choreography of Bob Fosse, whom she married, in history. She was just perfect for it. I think Fosse, because of his proximity to her, designed a lot of the choreography around her style of dance, and always great to watch. You might also remember Gwen Verdon. She was one of the old people in Cocoon who got younger without seeming to get younger and were taken up into space by aliens after swimming in a pool with a space egg in it. One of those dumb 1980s UFO as religious parable kind of movies that are now fortunately forgotten and relegated to the back shelves of DVD shops. Never liked it that much. Never been that big a fan of Ron Howard movies in general. I think they play to the cheap seats a bit too much. But back to Gwen Verdon and her dancing. In the film version, particularly the song A Little Brains, this shows you how the 1950s are a different planet than the noughties are. The choreography taken from the stage to the film, there were some quite suggestive hip movements by Gwen Verdon based on Bob Fosse's choreography. And if you see any of the retrospectives of Bob Fosse's choreography, you'll know what I mean. There's some quite subtle but very hot hip movements in there. They took them out of the film. They decided that this was during the same time as everyone was freaking out because Elvis Presley gyrated his hips. They were very kind of hip phobic in the 1950s for no real good reason. I mean, you could show somebody throwing an old lady down a flight of stairs in a wheelchair, but you couldn't show a woman gyrating her hips. Always seemed to me to be the wrong way around. So there are a couple of bits in the dance numbers there where Gwen Verdon's basically standing still because the choreography for that wasn't allowed in by the studios and the censors and all those other people whom we hold in low regard. She just pauses, and it's a really weird thing to see that once you know about it. You go, okay, that's why that happened. It seemed a bit odd to me at the time. I like Gwen Verdon. I think that she was a good actress. Her and Fosse had a parting of the ways, and if you see the movie All That Jazz, you can pretty much piece the story together from that kind of slightly Romana Clay autobiography that that All That Jazz became for Bob Fosse. Again, it's an interesting way of approaching it. It also shows the way that ancient stories and legends, particularly Faust, can be a good legend, can be reinterpreted in a modern context and have a lot of validity because of that. Now, I'm not going to talk too much more about Damn Yankees. What I tend to do is I tend to go to the bits where Gwen Verdon's singing and dancing and leave aside the fact that Tab Hunter's probably one of the worst actors ever to get a major gig in show business. He plays Joe Hardy, the baseball player. Ray Walston has a few good moments as Mr. Applegate. He gets to do a few bits of business which are over the top, and I think that that's one of the weaknesses of the film in a sense, that some of the acting by people who came across from the stage version is stage acting rather than cinema acting, and the gestures and the way they project their voices and things like that are more stage-based than cinema-based. Check it out. Cut to the dance numbers if you need to, but I just thought I'd put that in there because one of the 2 directors of the film, Stanley Donen, also directed the 2nd movie I'm going to talk about today, which is, of course, Bedazzled. Peter Cook, Dudley Moore, Eleanor Bron. Probably the best comedy cinema adaptation of Faust so far. I'll be back to talk about that in just a moment.
Would the words Prince of Darkness mean anything to you? Beelzebub? Mephistopheles? The Horned One?
I know you've escaped from somewhere.
No, I haven't, Mr. Moon. I'm the Horned One. The Devil. Let me give you my card.
Oh, yes, the Devil. Of course. So they help me. Cool. Blimey, I left my hanky at Wimpy's. I wonder if you'll excuse me.
Don't rush away, Mr. Moon.
You're a nutcase. You're a bleeding nutcase.
They said the same of Jesus Christ, Freud and Galileo.
They said it of a lot of nutcases, too.
You're not as stupid as you look, are you, Mr. Moon? What can I do to convince you that I'm the devil?
Okay, Bedazzled, 1967 film, written and starring Peter Cook and Dudley Moore. It retells the Faust legend in the swinging London of the 1960s, and it was remade in 2000, but don't worry about that because that movie was a pile of shit. Okay, the plot. Stanley Moon, Dudley Moore, was a dissatisfied, introverted young man who works in a Wimpy's restaurant and admires from afar the waitress Margaret, played by Eleanor Bron. Despairing of his unrequited infatuation, he's in the process of an incompetent suicide attempt when he's interrupted by George Spigot, Peter Cook, who is the devil. Spigot is in a contest with God, trying to be the first to gather 100 billion souls. If he achieves this first, he will be readmitted to heaven. So basically, George grants Stanley 7 wishes so that he can get his soul and, of course, lead towards that goal of getting 100 billion souls before God does. So basically, it's a competition between good and evil, but not in the usual way.
It's the standard contract. Gives you 7 wishes in accordance with the mystic rules of life. 7 days of the week, 7 deadly sins, 7 seas, 7 brides for 7 brothers. Look, if you're not interested, I'm sure there's thousands of others who'd jump at the opportunity.
No, it's just a bit sudden, that's all.
And the rule of 7 goes all the way through this movie. The 7 deadly sins turn up. For instance, anger is a bouncer in George Spigot's nightclub wearing a Make War Not Love t-shirt. Sloth is a sleeping lawyer. Envy is a very epicene guy who's jealous of everyone else. He's played by Barry Humphries, the Australian comedian and actor. Humphries based his role on Kenneth Tynan, the very influential theatre critic of the 1960s. He was holding his cigarette the way Tynan did and speaking the same kind of language. Voice, so there's a little bit of a subtext to that. Barry Humphries also said something very interesting about this film, that it's the only real satire of the zeitgeist of the 1960s that was actually made in the 1960s. The people who made this, particularly Peter Cook and Dudley Moore, were taking the piss out of contemporary society at a time when everybody thought that the summer of love and the 1960s and the changes in society were going to be uniformly wonderful. They decided to take the piss out of it. And not only that, they didn't only take the piss out of the 1960s Carnaby Street hippie scene kind of thing. The things they knocked, there were a lot of them. I mean, they knocked religion, they knocked the ruling class, pretentious intellectuals, the police, pop music and music fans, and ultimately the selfish, snobbish and standoffish nature of the traditional Christian God. God does not come across very well in this movie, which is probably another reason why, apart from the changing of the devil's gender, that the remake of Bedazzled didn't work. They were too careful about the theology of it, whereas in the original Bedazzled, they were up front. They said that, you know, the devil wasn't particularly a bad guy. He made a mistake. He got fed up with hanging out with God, telling him how good he was for eternity. And when ultimately God loses the competition and George Spigot wins, God reneges on the deal through a pretty low act. And the last sound you hear in the movie are the mocking laughter of the Christian God. So I know there are some religious people who listen to this, and I'm not trying to knock you guys. I'm just saying that one of the things satirised in this movie, that there is nothing taboo in the satire, and which for the 1960s is quite an outrageous thing to do, even at a time when things were almost mandatorily outrageous. They took it to that level where basically they said that the way traditional religion looks at God is a bad thing. If you went by what people were telling them at the time, these God wasn't a nice guy. But leaving aside the theology for a moment, there are some other fantastic bits of this, one of which doesn't get a lot of airtime, is how good Eleanor Bron is in this film. She plays a whole bunch of different variations of Margaret Spencer, the character with whom Stanley Moon is infatuated. And there are different accents, different hairstyles, different. Basically, each one is a different woman. But ultimately, I think one of the nice conceits of the movie is the fact that each one of these variations on Margaret are not particularly real women. They're variations of the fantasies of the Stanley Moon character. Eleanor Bron, great actress. She's still working. Seen her in a lot of things subsequent to this, including an episode of Hippies, which was a very early TV series that Simon Pegg did, where she played the mother of one of his friends who was into plaster casting celebrity dicks. Now, if you ever get a chance to see that TV series and that episode, it's quite hilarious. And Simon Pegg in it is as good as Eleanor Bron, and of course she's got iconic status because of this movie as well. She's an icon of the 1960s. But the bit everyone remembers from Bedazzled, of course, is the Top of the Pop style music scene. I'll just play a little sting from both of the songs in that one, and we'll talk about that a little bit more.
Love me! Won't you please come and love me?
Oh, love me.
I need you so, please don't go, stay and love me.
Oh, love me.
Tell me you're full of yearning for me.
Oh, love me.
Ooh, I'm bedazzled.
I don't care.
Okay, I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that that's probably the best musical pastiche in cinema history. The film direction, the black and white photography, the way the sets set up, the musical pastiche, all the music in this film was by Dudley Moore, who was quite an accomplished jazz pianist, as well as being an actor and comedian. He and Peter Cook, of course, started out on the stage in the early 1960s doing satirical reviews, which were incredibly popular. In fact, they moved over to New York and were done on Broadway after being very successful in London. But just this is where it all came together for them. This is the kind of epitome of Peter Cook and Dudley Moore working together. Some people like Derek and Clive. I'm less fond of them than I am with a lot of their other stuff, and I don't think Dudley Moore ever quite did anything as good as this again. I think a lot of the Arthur kind of things and Ten and movies like that basically are lesser vehicles. I think the Peter Cook and Dudley Moore combination was a brilliant piece of casting. The guys played off each other fantastically well, and of course this shows in the scripts, the script of Bedazzled. The dialogue between the two of them is perfectly timed. There's a lot of subtle wordplay as well as the overt wordplay in them, and just it's a joy to rewatch, you know, a lot of the time. I also like the Leaping Nuns too, just getting off on another subject. I like the idea of an order of nuns who base their whole religious order on something that was witnessed by a two-year-old girl who founded their order years later. The recollections of a two-year-old girl were used for the whole basis of the theology for this order of trampolining nuns. So I like that kind of level of satire, which takes some of the more absurd aspects of Catholicism and just runs with them. Not a lot else to say about Bedazzled. Everybody's seen it, but again, it's a fantastic variation on Faust. It brings those seven deadly sins into it. It brings the spirit of the times into the Faust legend as a way of satirizing not just, you know, just basically everything, but also there's a line here where there's a voyage of discovery for the Stanley Moon character. Oh, before I forget, Stanley Moon is a name that was invented by John Gielgud. He'd seen Dudley Moore on the stage and wrote him a letter and got his name wrong. And rather than Dudley Moore, he somehow got it into his head that Dudley Moore's name was Stanley Moon. And, of course, as a bit of a homage to that, they used it for the character in Bedazzled. So that's just a sideline. But the voyage of discovery is Stanley Moon going from basically a useless little whiny stalker to a man who is going to live life on his own terms and get the things he wants by his own actions rather than moaning about them and hoping that somebody else will fix it and change it for him. Stanley does learn things from his friendship, and there is a friendship between him and the devil. He learns that there are no shortcuts to achieving in life, and that you really have to kind of get off your ass and do something yourself to make things happen. And I like that. I like the fact that there's that serious, very thin serious vein running through the movie as well. So if you haven't got a copy of that, why not? Definitely do so. You don't lose anything from rewatching it every couple of years. In fact, I keep seeing more and new things in it each time I watch it. In that case, it's definitely a classic film. It's rewatchability is an underrated quality in movies. As I said, I've got over 3,000 films now, and some of them I have more difficulty rewatching than others, but this one definitely worth checking out repeatedly. In a moment, I'll talk about the last one of the movies, Brian De Palma's Phantom of the Paradise.
We'll remember you forever, Eddie. Through the sacrifice you made, we can't believe the price you paid for love.
Phantom of the Paradise is a 1974 horror thriller comedy musical written and directed by Brian De Palma, who we know from a lot of other films. Carrie, most recently, was it Black Dahlia or something like that? But he did a lot of films. Mostly, he's very influenced by Alfred Hitchcock in a number of his movies, but this one, I think, is the lightest film he did. He did Sisters just before this movie, a very dark and crazed horror movie, and a lot of the same actors who were in this film were in that one as well, particularly the main character, Winslow Leach, played by William Finley, a New York-based actor. The story is a weird mixture of Phantom of the Opera, Hunchback of Notre Dame, The Picture of Dorian Gray, and Faust, all of them mixed in together in various places, and I think it works really, really well together. Basically, the story is, well, we'll probably should let Rod Serling give a bit of background to it.
Swan. He has no other name. His past is a mystery, but his work is already a legend. He wrote and produced his first gold record at 14. In the years since then, he has won so many others that he once tried to deposit them in Fort Knox. He brought the blues to Britain. He brought Liverpool to America. He brought folk and rock together. His band, the Juicy Fruits, single-handedly gave birth to the nostalgia wave of the 70s. Now he is looking for the new sound of the Spheres to inaugurate his own Xanadu, his own Disneyland. The paradise, the ultimate rock palace. This film is the story of that search, of that sound, of the man who made it, the girl who sang it, and the monster who stole it.
Love the fact that they got Rod Serling to do that. Basically, that's the story. Winslow Leach is a musician. He's written a cantata based on the legend of Faust. and it gets heard by Swan, played by Paul Williams, who decides with his sidekick, henchman, major domo, conciliary kind of character, a guy called Philbin, played by George Mamoli, to steal Winslow's music, frame him on a drug bust, and get him thrown into jail, which they very quickly do. While he's in jail, Winslow has his teeth extracted and replaced with metal teeth because, you know, you can't get a disease from a metal tooth. And he escapes, tries to ruin the recording plant where Swan's records for his label Death Records are produced, and accidentally gets part of his head crushed in a record pressing machine. He then goes to the Paradise, which is Swan's musical Xanadu, the place he's going to be opening with Winslow's music, and becomes the Phantom of the Paradise, trying to undermine and destroy Swan while trying to protect the girl he's fallen in love with, a singer called Phoenix, played by Jessica Harper. So there are a lot of aspects to this movie which parallel a movie that came out pretty much at the same time, which was Rocky Horror Picture Show. Rocky Horror Show, the stage version, came out about a year before Phantom of the Paradise was made. I don't know whether De Palma, who wrote this movie, had any awareness of Rocky Horror, but there are a lot of similarities there, particularly with the character of Beef, who is a very kind of gay glam rocker, whose stage performance echoes some of the stuff that's in Rocky Horror. I mean, you know, I don't think that De Palma really... There's enough difference there that it doesn't really matter too much. Both movies can stand on their own, and I like the fact that all these different legends are merged in together in this film to make a pretty consistent whole. So, and there are actually some tour de force moments in this movie. We all know that De Palma is known for his homages to other... the filmmakers, Hitchcock, people like that. But there is a scene where the Phantom plants a bomb in a stage car, which is wheeled out on the stage while the Juicy Fruits, who have now metamorphosized into a beach band called the Beach Bums, which is a part of the... There are musical pastiches through the film. They're hot, and this is their Beach Boys kind of pastiche, where they have different iterations of Winslow's music and they turn it into a beach song. They turn one of the tunes into a beach song. And the planting of the bomb in the car and the car being wheeled out on stage and things parallels very strongly the first scene in Orson Welles' Touch of Evil, where the bomb's planted in the car and Charlton Heston and Janet Leigh walk through the border before the car explodes. So it's quite a nice little Easter egg, and it's very well done. The camera setups must have been very complicated, and the rehearsal process must have been very complicated for that too, because it's all done in one shot. There's no cutting in it, as indeed happened in Touch of Evil, of course. But really nice to see that. There's a little scene which is a bit of an homage to Psycho, where Winslow warns off Beef and tells him not to do the music because Winslow wants it to be Phoenix's only. And, of course, there's a shower scene there which plays out comically. I think if there's a weak spot in this movie, I think it's Paul Williams. I think the Swan character needs to be a lot stronger than Paul Williams as an actor was able to portray it. His music works really well in the movie. I had the soundtrack album back when it was on vinyl, which shows how long ago it was. And I do like the music from this film, but I think maybe another actor playing Swan would have worked better. There were some casting ideas that originally came out when the movie was going to be made, which were quite funky. They wanted the Juicy Fruits originally, the three-piece band who metamorphosized at Swan's whim from being a nostalgia band to being a beach band to being a kind of glam rock goth band in the end called the Undeads. Originally that was going to be played by Sha Na Na, the big nostalgia craze band who, amongst other things, appeared at Woodstock and did At the Hop in the movie documentary of Woodstock. But they couldn't really work that, so they created their own group out of a bunch of comedy actors and musicians they had at the time and ran with that. And I think it works really well for that. Originally, the Phantom of the Paradise wasn't going to be played by William Finley. Originally, the character was going to be played by Paul Williams. And the character that Swan of Swan was originally called Spectre because it was going to be a pastiche of Phil Spector. It was going to be played by Gerrit Graham, who ended up playing Beef. Beef, originally, the big glam rock hunk guy, was going to be played by Peter Boyle, who just had a big success playing the monster in Young Frankenstein, but that one didn't pan out. And so Gerrit Graham got the Beef role, Paul Williams got the role of Swan, and William Finley came in to do the role of Winslow Leach slash the Phantom of the Paradise. So the casting was a bit problematic. They also had problem getting money from the studios. The studio didn't really want to have a bar of this film. It was a little too out there for the studios at the time, so they basically got half of the budget from a real estate developer. And the studio came in and ponied up the other half for it. Jessica Harper, this wasn't her first film, but it was one of her very early films. Originally, they were trying to find someone to play Phoenix in this movie, somebody who could sing and dance and had some presence to her. Amongst other people, Linda Ronstadt applied to play this role. It was decided that Jessica Harper was a much better deal. She went on to do another number of other good films after that. She was actually in the sequel to Rocky Horror Picture Show, Shock Treatment, which is a bit of a funky and cult favourite of mine. I used to hang out with friends in Canberra, and every now and then we'd play Shock Treatment on VHS for friends and things like that, and to introduce new people to the movie. She was in that film. She was also in My Favourite Year, the movie Richard Benjamin directed with Peter O'Toole, the one that was kind of like a nostalgia piece about a Errol Flynn-type character doing a live TV show in the 1950s. Another good film in which Jessica Harper was very good. The most recent thing I remember seeing her in was she was a minor character in Spielberg's Minority Report, the Tom Cruise film, which was a pretty good film apart from the fact that it had Tom Cruise in it. Hasn't done a lot of things, but a memorable actress and very good singer. She used her own voice in the singing in this film and did an extremely good job of it. As you might guess from the plotline of the film, things don't end well for pretty much any of the characters. There's a big scene at the end where most of the main characters die in various ways, and it all ends in blood and tragedy and horror, and that's the way it should be in this sort of film. At the time of its release, the movie wasn't a big success, except in one particular corner of the planet. For some odd reason, and this goes back to the theory of memes where certain ideas take root in a place and are really one with it. Winnipeg in Canada really loved this movie. It went gangbusters for them. People could not get enough of this film in Winnipeg. So it stayed in the local cinemas there for over 4 months continuously and for over 1 year non-continuously until 1976. The soundtrack sold 20,000 copies in Winnipeg alone, and it got gold record status in Canada. The film was shown there on an IMAX screen in the 1990s, and in 2006 some fans organised a festival dubbed Fandapalooza, which reunited the original cast and featured a concert by Paul Williams in the theatre where the film played during its original run in Winnipeg. So it's one of those things where certain films get a cult status in certain places, and just remember, the best example I can remember from my own life is Dirty Mary, Crazy Larry, which I've mentioned in a previous podcast, was incredibly popular in the western suburbs of Sydney beyond all recognition. It would repeat for years and years there. Everybody in the western suburbs of Sydney who was like a car buff loved that movie for the car chases. Same with Vanishing Point. Any of these kind of muscle car movies did incredibly well and went incredibly viral out where I used to live when I was a teenager. And every few weeks you'd see Dirty Mary, Crazy Larry. They must have worn prints out just distributing it around the place. It was incredibly popular there. And in the same way, a certain film just gets in with the local culture in a place and runs with it. If you can think of any other examples of that. In fact, I'll make that a question. What movie that wasn't really popular on a wide scale was popular where you live? So drop me an email at kultguru@gmail.com and let me know which movies from your early days were very popular in your town but didn't seem to be too popular elsewhere. I'm sure there are a lot of them, and I'd be very interested to hear what they are. So I'll just play another little bit of a tune from Phantom of the Paradise, and I'll wrap it up and let you guys get on with your lives.
Carburetors, man. That's what life is all about. Myself last night, lost the fight, my Woody barely running. By a dude I should have beat, and on the street, a blow like that is gunning. I finally lost control, I tore my tuck and roll.
You can find the soundtrack album to Phantom of the Paradise pretty easily. It is available, I think, on Amazon. And if, like me, you're cash-strapped, you can also find it if you type, say, Phantom of the Paradise and Blogspot into Google. I think you'll find that there are some people doing a bit of a charity on that as well. I don't mind downloading that one for myself. I bought the album on vinyl. I still have the album on vinyl. It just happens that I've kind of upgraded the quality of it by downloading a torrent. So, no, up to you whether you do that or not, but it is available there, as is the soundtrack to Bedazzled. So either pay for it if you're inclined to, or if you do a little bit of a hunt around, I'm sure you can find it by an extra legal means. So that's about it for the podcast this time around. I will be doing children's movies at some stage in the future. I'm kind of getting things together for that, and I may even, one of the thoughts I had, and let me know what you think about this idea. I thought I might do like a mini podcast in between the other podcasts where I just look at one film, maybe a kid's film, and do a bit of a rant and a rave about that one, just maybe 20 minutes, 25 minutes or something like that, rather than the almost an hour that these ones are taking. Kind of give you a little bit in between the 3 weeks that I have on this podcast, so let me know what you think about that idea. Let me know which movies went really viral where you live and were shown for a great length of time where you live, or were really popular on DVD or video. Just a bit of feedback about which films people liked when you were a kid. So anyway, that's about it for this time around. I'll leave you with all the contact details as a tag at the end of this. If you download this through iTunes, definitely leave a review or a comment there if you're able to. Always helps me get a larger audience for the podcast if people do that. And also, if you go to podcastalley.com, you can vote each month on Paleo Cinema, get us up there in the ratings, and we get a little more exposure like that. The number of listeners is increasing. We're getting a lot more people who are subscribing to the feed. If you don't know how to subscribe to a feed, probably the easiest way is through iTunes or any other podcast aggregator, and I will put the RSS feed link. You just on the website, you just paste that in there, and you can anytime there's an update, it will, and you synchronize your iPod, it will enable you to access it, or any other MP3 player for that matter. I'm getting all tongue-tied about the technicalities there, but I do know what I mean. So that's about it. Keep the letters and keep the emails coming, and I would hope I'll get some audio as well. Hope you enjoyed this one, and I'll be back in 3 weeks with something entirely different. Not sure what yet. I've got a few ideas, but I haven't quite nailed them down. So enjoy your movies, and I will catch you later.
Paleo Cinema is a 3-weekly podcast that looks at film noir, horror, cult movies, classic films, science fiction, and other genre works from 1895 to 1980. The email address is cultguru@gmail.com, cultguru@gmail.com. So please send comments, feedback, and MP3 voicemails to that address. The blog for the podcast, which has lots of extra content relating to each episode and a chat window where you can interact with other listeners, is paleo-cinema.com. www.cinemanoir.blogspot.com. This podcast contains adult content and occasional swearing, so don't lend your MP3 player to children.